good for nothing more than reflecting off the white of the snow below, and she slipped on her sunglasses. Daniel Birkel's shadow hung over Freiburg. Her hometown was too dangerous. Even if she didn't run into him, there were too many people who could recognize her. Too many people happy to help the Gestapo. There was no need to go to the pharmacy in the city like last time. Sankt Peter was just a couple of miles away. It was a small town, but had a grocery store and a medical center. It would do for their needs this time. She strapped on her skis and set out. Franka thought about John Lynch and what Philadelphia must have looked like. She thought about Rudolf Hahn and what she was going to say to him. She saw no one until she reached the line outside the grocery store. She joined at the back, resting her skis against the wall. No familiar faces gawked at her. Most of the people she knew from here were away at war or dead already. It was a relief to be anonymous. She mixed her ration coupons with the ones John had given her, so the fakes wouldn't stand out. It worked. The shopkeeper didn't notice. She hid her elation as she left the store, her rucksack as full as her collection of ration vouchers allowed. The narrow streets of the small town of Sankt Peter were deathly quiet. Franka kept her head down as she trudged along the sidewalk all the way to the medical center. A teenager with his arm in a sling glanced up at her as she pushed the door open. Beside him sat two young men, missing eyes and arms, one in a wheelchair, the other on crutches. The war had penetrated every inch of German society. No one was immune. A gray-faced old woman sat behind a drab wooden desk covered with papers. Franka went to her and waited her turn behind a mother with a baby in her arms. Once Franka's turn came, the woman behind the desk peered up at her with tired eyes.
"I'm here to see Martina Krüger. She's a nurse here."
"What's your business with Nurse Krüger?"
"I'm an old friend. It's of a personal nature."
"Nurse Krüger is busy. Why don't you..."
"It won't take more than a few minutes,"
Franka said. The woman grumbled under her breath.
"Perhaps she's due a break."
"Give me 1 minute."
The woman disappeared through a door behind her. 2 minutes passed before the door opened again, and Martina smiled, throwing her arms around Franka. They had known each other since they were children, had met in kindergarten, and gone through school together. Martina had been in the same troop in the League of German Girls. Franka hadn't seen her since she'd left for Munich in 39. She looked almost the same, pretty, with long brown hair and shining green eyes. The woman glared at Martina, who scowled back before leading Franka outside. She lit a cigarette and offered one to Franka, who shook her head. They talked about Martina's family for a couple of minutes. She had two daughters and a husband stationed in France. Franka trusted her, not enough to ask her for morphine, or anything she might get in trouble for, but surely a pair of old crutches wouldn't be missed.
"What are you doing back here?"
Martina said. Franka wondered how much she knew. Probably everything.
"I came back to hear the reading of my father's will. I was so sorry to hear that he died. I saw his name in the paper. I couldn't believe it. Thank you. It seemed so random in a city that has hardly been touched. The bombs are coming. It's only a matter of time before the Allies try to murder us all."
Franka ignored the comment, although she felt a sharp pike of anger stab through her.
"I'm sorry not to see you for so long and then ask you for a favor, but I need something."
Martina lit up another cigarette.
"Of course. What is it?" "I'm staying in my parents' old cabin in the mountains. You remember it, don't you?" "Yes, of course. I'm there with my boyfriend."
Martina's eyes lit up.
"You never told me you were seeing anyone. Is it serious?" "I think it might be. He's a medic, but he's back from the front. We're taking some time together while we can. We have a problem, however. He broke his leg skiing, and we're snowed in." Oh, no. It's not been easy. I managed to set a cast on his legs myself. I thought it was just one leg. No, it's two. I meant to say two.
Franca could feel her heart thumping in her chest. Martina's expression changed to grave seriousness.
He's okay, and in casts, but he can't get around. I need some crutches. I was wondering if you had any old sets lying around that I could borrow for a few weeks, until the snow melts. Does he need a doctor? Shall I ask? No, that won't be necessary. I just need crutches. I was able to set his legs, and they seem to be healing well.
Franca stopped talking. Martina finished her cigarette and crushed it under her foot. She looked around to see if anyone was listening in.
When do you need them? Now, if possible. Give me a few minutes, and I'll see what I can do.
Franca waited outside in the cold for 15 minutes, and was just beginning to wonder if she was coming back, when Martina emerged, a pair of old crutches under her arm.
These have seen a few winters, but they should do the job. I don't think they'll be missed either. Thank you so much,
Franca said, as Martina handed them to her.
This is going to mean the world to Tommy.
Martina stayed with Franca a few more minutes, before duty called, and they said their goodbyes. Franca tied the crutches to her backpack and made her way out of town, explaining to the guard who stopped her that they were for her war veteran boyfriend. He didn't ask questions after that, and handed her papers back. Franca arrived back at the cabin, brandishing the crutches like a trophy. John slipped them under his armpits and pushed himself upward. Movement was still difficult, and he had to drag his legs behind him, but his situation now was miles ahead of being stuck in bed. His first journey was to the kitchen. They sat at the table together as Franca made up a meal of soup, bread, and cheese, and they ate it like it would be their last. Later that day, Martina Kruger thought long and hard about the meeting with her old friend. Why hadn't Franca wanted her boyfriend to see a doctor? Even if the bones were healing well, surely it would have been better to make sure. The thought stayed with her through Christmas, and even into the new year of 1944. She couldn't shake the way Franca had looked at her, and how unusual her request was. It was with some regret that she went to the local Gestapo office to report her friend. It was probably nothing, she reasoned, and surely Franca didn't have anything to hide, but it was best to let the professionals deal with it. She suppressed any feelings she had about loyalty to friends, because in times of war like these, it was more important to put the Führer first. Franca Gerber was a criminal after all, and Martina couldn't risk getting involved. She had her family to think about. The Gestapo agent agreed with her. She had done the right thing. Christmas came. They spent it together. They talked for hours on end. She went through every idea that the White Rose championed, and he told her he'd heard of the massive drops all over Germany of the Munich Students' Manifesto. That was her Christmas present, the quiet satisfaction that what they'd done hadn't been in vain. She told him of her childhood in the mountains. They had time to go through every summer she spent here, every memory she had. He taught her some English phrases, military language mostly. He told her of Philadelphia, his parents' house, and sunny days at the shore during the summer. He talked about his father's business, and how uncomfortable he was with the privilege he'd been raised in. But the way he spoke about it was different from before. It wasn't something to hold a grudge over. There were far more important things to live and die for. He told her about meeting his wife in Princeton, and about how happy their first few years together had been. She married her airman a week after the divorce went through, a month before John shipped out. He'd never told anyone his story this thoroughly before. His ex-wife, his childhood, his parents, and where he'd grown up. He'd never had the time. He went through every conceivable detail he could remember about Rudolf Hahn, and told her everything he knew about his work, which wasn't much. There were parts of the mission shrouded even from him. He didn't need to know everything. They talked about how they'd get Han back to the cabin. It would be best to wait until John's legs healed. That would be at the end of January. Only then could they strike for the border. With all they talked about, all the hours they spent together, they never mentioned the future. They never spoke about what Franco would do once John set off for Switzerland with Han. Only the mission mattered. He repeated those phrases over and over in his mind, until they became a mantra, words to live by. Franco moved his bed above the pried-up boards in the bedroom. They developed a drill. What to do if the Gestapo did come looking for him? They went through it dozens of times. The only warning they would have would be the sound of a car pulling up. In that case, John was to go to the bedroom immediately and slip the boards over himself as he lay in the space beneath that she'd made as comfortable as she could. The bed would cover the floorboards, which in turn would cover him. There would be no hiding if the Gestapo conducted a thorough search. But what reason would there be to do so? No word had come in the local papers of missing Allied airmen or of spies. It seemed that they didn't know he was in the area, let alone hiding in her father's cabin. The new year came. She had seen no one but him since her last trip to town almost 2 weeks before, when she had only spoken to Martina, the officer who'd asked for her papers, and the people working in the various stores she visited. John was spending more time outside the room. When she returned from her daily walk, she often found him sitting in the rocking chair by the fire, reading banned literature. He wanted to read only the books that the Nazis would throw her in jail for. The stiffer the sentence for having it, the more he wanted to read it. The Magic Mountain, by Thomas Mann, sat on the table where he'd left it, his bookmark jutting out. They only listened to illegal foreign radio stations, reveling in the freedom of their solitude. She was fascinated as he told her about what was going on elsewhere in the war, the battles in Russia and Italy, the combat in the Pacific. She cooked stew most nights, and he helped cut and dice the vegetables so thinly that they melted in her mouth. They had started eating together on Christmas Day, and it was a habit now. They were silent as they ate that night in January. His table manners were exquisite. She tried to imagine him sitting down with his fellow soldiers and eating the sea rations he'd described in such detail. It was hard to picture. He raised his napkin and dabbed away breadcrumbs on the sides of his mouth before continuing with his meal. "I see you looking at me with that smile on your face," he said. "What are you thinking about?"
"I'm just trying to picture you with your fellow soldiers, the grunts, as you called them."
She was proud of herself for using the English slang he'd taught her. It took a while for some of them to accept me in basic training. Once they saw that we were all on the same side, and prejudice against your own could cost you your life, I'd like to think I earned their respect. He put his fork down, his meal unfinished. "I know you're nervous about tomorrow," he said. "Everything will be okay. You only need to speak to him for a few minutes. No one will suspect a thing. As far as we know, he's not under any suspicion."
"As far as you know?"
"Of course, there are things we don't know. But I wouldn't trust this job to just anyone."
"You don't have much choice."
"Of course I do. I could wait. Han might change his mind or finish his work or get caught. Or something else could happen in the meantime. But I can't wait, and I can't go myself." He reached across the table and took her hand. "When are you going to realize what a valuable asset you are to this mission? I can't believe I found you. If it weren't for you, I'd be dead already." Franco pulled her hand away and picked up the cup of coffee in front of her.
"What makes you so sure I can do this?"
"I can see the strength in you. Who else could have done what you've done and still keep going?"
"The fire needs tending to."
"Never mind that. It can wait a few minutes. He reached for her hand again. His hands were warm, strong. You can do this. You have every quality inside you to do this. You're brave, and...
I'm not brave. I'm a coward.
She felt the tears coming, and was ashamed to cry in front of him.
I sold out the same way in the skin. I pretended I didn't know what was going on, and what Hans and the others were doing.
She turned away from him, grabbing for the wood stacked in the corner. The fire under the stove crackled as she tossed on a couple of logs.
They were the real heroes, prepared to give their lives for what they believed in.
The fact that they're dead doesn't make them heroes any more than you are. Don't you think they would have chosen life if they could have? What good would have come of your death? What would one more death have achieved?
I should have confessed to the truth of what I did and what I knew. I played that stupid blonde. I acted out the role of the idiotic girl.
You did what you needed to do to survive. I would have done exactly the same thing in your place. You were brave. You were smart. And now you're alive. And because of you, so am I. You are blonde, and you are a woman. But you're as far from stupid or cowardly as anyone I've ever met. His kind words did nothing to hold the tears, which came harder and faster and dripped off the edge of her chin. He used his crutches to struggle out of his seat and get to her. You might be the bravest person I've ever known, Franka Gerber.
I left him,
she said. What? John said. Her words were as faint as ash on the wind.
It's my fault he died. I left him. My father couldn't care for him alone.
Oh, no, that's not true. John could feel the warmth of her on his skin.
I should never have gone. It's my fault Freddy died. If I'd stayed in Freiburg, we could have taken care of him together. He would never have been in that home, and they would never have gotten their claws on him. He'd still be alive.
It's not your fault Freddy died. The Nazis murdered him.
Why did I have to go to Munich? Why did I leave him?
You wanted a new start. You were 22.
You say that, but...
Freddy's death isn't your fault. Who's to say that they wouldn't have come to your house for him? There was nothing you could have done about it. There was no way you could have known.
He would never have died.
You have an opportunity to strike back at the heart of the regime that murdered your brother and your boyfriend. They don't realize how important this nuclear program is. We have to stop it before they find out. According to Hahn, they're ahead of us. If we let the Nazis develop their program first, they might never pay for murdering Freddy and so many others.
It's too late. The damage is done.
It's never too late. Not while you've got breath in your lungs and life within you. The Nazis have left a trail of millions of victims throughout Europe. You've been gifted the chance to fight for justice on their behalf.
Or revenge.
Either, he said. Both. There are many different combinations of reasons for what we do. Revenge is one of them. I need to know if you're in this 100%, Franka. Any less and you're endangering both our lives. Are you with me?
I am. 100%.
Chapter 11. Franka was awake before the dawn, and she watched as the dark of night submitted to the dull gray of an overcast morning. She waited an hour to climb out of bed, wincing as the cold of the cabin bit at her face. It was a 2-hour train ride to Stuttgart from Freiburg. The roads were still impassable, her car little more than a reminder of how she got up here and how she might leave. Hot coffee warmed her. She checked the food supplies for John, though she already knew exactly how much food they had. She checked again. His voice came through his door, and with steaming mug of coffee in hand, she went to him. He was sitting up in the bed. You can do this. You're just meeting someone in Stuttgart. They talked about the journey for a few minutes before she went to the bathroom to wash up. He was in the kitchen as she emerged, her hair stinging her scalp in the cold air. They sat and ate breakfast together. John went over everything again, even though she had it all memorized. She was packed and ready to go 15 minutes later, and he propelled himself to the door to shake her hand as they said their goodbyes.
"I'll see you tomorrow,"
she said. She tried to show the best side of herself, to hide the anxiety that seemed to be eroding her from the inside out. But she saw the uneasy look in his eyes. Franka didn't move as the train pulled into the Stuttgart Hauptbahnhof station. Her mind was blank, as devoid of color as the snow that fell in the mountains. The soldier sitting opposite her offered to help with her bag. She clutched it tight and declined with a polite word. He tipped his hat to her and stood to get off the train. She forced herself out of her seat, aware of how pale she must have looked. She hadn't eaten, hadn't moved since she'd boarded. Her hands were shaking. She stuck them in her coat pockets and stood up. Franka followed as the rest of the passengers shuffled off the train and onto the platform. The train was on time. The clock on the wall read 3:15. There would be more than enough time to find a hotel before she went to meet Hahn. Several uniformed Gestapo men stopped members of the crowd to check for papers. They left her alone, seemingly more focused on men of military serving age. They were looking for deserters. The air was cold as she stepped out of the station. It was a cloudy, misty day. A line of massive Nazi flags flew on 50-foot-high poles, barely visible through the murk. An enormous portrait of Hitler stood 10 feet tall at the entrance to the station. Franka stuck her arm out for a taxi. She forced herself to eat something after checking into her hotel and made her way down toward the Schlossplatz, a large square in the middle of the city where Hahn would be for those precious 10 minutes. She ambled through the Baroque gardens of the plaza to the statue of the Roman goddess Concordia, jutting out of the center, almost 100 feet into the sky. Bombing had scarred the buildings around the square, which faded into one another in the poor visibility. Some were under construction once more. Some were not. A massive Nazi flag billowed in the air, and several off-duty soldiers sauntered past. Her entire body stiffened at their glances. There seemed to be enemies everywhere, and she could feel the eyes of every passerby attached to her, like leeches to skin. She took a seat on a park bench overlooking the square, wishing she smoked, to calm her nerves if nothing else. She resisted the urge to look at her wristwatch. A man across the square stopped, seemed to look at her, and then continued on. The seconds drew out like days. And then she saw him. A man in his 50s, in a beige trench coat, made his way across the square and sat down on a park bench 30 yards from her. He was wearing a hat, but he had the grey moustache that John had described. He raised a newspaper in front of his face, just as John had said he would. Should she go straight to him? She looked over each shoulder, trying to make it look like she was expecting someone. A man in his 30s sat down beside her, glancing over. "Beautiful place, isn't it?" he said, and Franka's heart froze.
"Yes,"
she replied, barely getting the words out. She didn't bring her eyes to look at him, though she knew he was looking at her. She looked at her wrist, and then at the man in the beige trench coat. Hahn would be gone in 8 minutes. Who was this man beside her? The sweet aroma of cigarette smoke filled her nostrils. "Would you like one?" the man said. He was holding the cigarette pack out to her. She shook her head. His smile betrayed crooked front teeth, and he had a deep scar down his cheek. His grey eyes were unreadable.
"I don't smoke,"
she said.
"Nasty habit.
The Führer himself has spoken out against it. He took a deep drag.
I've never partaken myself, if you'll excuse me.
He stood up and ambled away without another word. The man in the beige coat was still reading his newspaper and didn't react as she sat down beside him. The man who'd offered a cigarette glanced at them.
Fine weather for this time of year,
she said.
It's a treat for the children.
Han whirled his head around upon hearing her words. It took him a couple of seconds to regain his composure. He had an umbrella by his side, just as John said he would.
Fine weather for ice skating, not for the farmers trying to feed our brave soldiers on the front.
His words were practiced, deliberate. They were the code words. He turned the page, keeping the newspaper in front of his face. She knew she had to speak next, but eyed the man smoking the cigarette. He was looking, but averted his eyes as he noticed her peering back at him. A soldier in SS uniform walked past them.
Is it safe to speak here?
Perhaps not, he said,
but didn't move.
You're not quite whom I was expecting.
There was a problem with the original operative. He wasn't able to make it.
Han turned to her as she continued.
He's alive and well. He had some issues, however, and won't be able to travel for a few weeks.
She stared out in front as she spoke, aware that though his newspaper was in front of him, he was looking around it at her.
I'm going to get up, he said. I'll wait for you at the corner of the street over there. Come in 5 minutes and we can walk together.
He folded up his newspaper and tucked it under his arm as he stood. She tried not to check her watch more than a couple of times. The man who'd offered her a cigarette was talking to someone else on the bench now, seemingly oblivious. As soon as she'd counted out the 5 minutes, she made her way over to Han, who greeted her with a handshake.
You know who I am, but I don't know you. What do I call you?
Franke. I'm German.
Do you speak for our allied friends? Can you make promises on their behalf?
Yes, I can.
John had assured her of that much.
You say that your man cannot travel. What exactly is the problem?
He has 2 broken legs. He's recovering in a cabin near Freiburg.
Han waited until they passed a soldier and his girlfriend, walking arm in arm.
That could be a problem. There's been a change of plan.
What change of plan would that be?
I want to get my wife out with me.
I thought you were divorced, with a daughter living in exile in Switzerland.
Heidi is in Zurich, yes. But I can't in good conscience leave my wife behind. The bombing has stepped up in recent weeks. It seems that the Allies have absolute rule over the skies of Germany now. Thousands are being slaughtered, and God help us all if the Soviets come. I can't leave her to face that fate alone.
I'll see what we can work out.
Han stopped.
If she doesn't come, I don't either.
Franco tried to picture John hobbling on legs barely healed, and trying to lead a couple in their 50s through the frozen forest to Switzerland. It didn't seem plausible.
I'll talk to our friend about it. I have a number of questions for you, too.
Franco looked around. No one stood within earshot. They walked on.
I trust you've organized the house I demanded. I want a house on the beach, and 2 cars, 1 German and 1 American.
Han smiled to himself.
I want to be the leader of the team I'm working with, and I want control of the study.
Everything has been taken care of,
Franke said.
How is your work progressing?
We're drawing closer to a breakthrough.
What about the Nazi leadership? Are they beginning to pay attention?
I had a letter from Himmler last week, praising me on the progress that we've made. The rumor is that he wants to make us his pet project. He's going to use our findings to curry favor with Hitler. He's in the process of scheduling a visit. If Himmler can get Hitler's approval, then we'll get all the funding we require, and we'll be able to develop our weapon.
The word weapon jarred her, and the questions multiplied, but she remained on task, remembering John's words.
Is there no way you can stop the progress?
I'm part of a team. If I were to make some kind of deliberate mistake, then the rest of the team would notice. I could be thrown off the project, and in that case, your people would have no one inside. I couldn't do that. It would harm my reputation. And besides, your masters want me to continue with my progress as far as I can, before they steal it for themselves. They don't believe that the Nazi leadership is going to back us to the necessary extent we'd need to finish the job. They think the war will be over by the time we get to the stage of having something we could actually use.
Are they correct?
Maybe, maybe not. It's difficult to say. It's a dangerous game they're playing.
Could the work continue without you?
Yes, but I am the spearhead and the driving force behind it. I am also the public face. Without me, people like Himmler will lose interest, and the project will be overlooked in favor of the jet engine development Hitler believes can turn the tide of the war. Our project is one of many, claiming to be the savior of Germany. It's just that I happen to know the true potential of what we're doing. It's been difficult to get others to realize it, too. This meeting with Himmler could make or break our project.
It was hard to tell whether he was anti-Nazi or not. She was beginning to get the impression that if they didn't steal him away, he would see the project out to its resolution in Germany, and the Nazis would be able to make use of the potential of this weapon he'd mentioned. Perhaps he only wanted to make use of the Americans' superior facilities and funding. Perhaps the project itself was all that counted, and scientific discovery was all that mattered to him, not to what ends that science would be used. A man with no loyalties other than his work was a dangerous one. They walked in silence for a few minutes, passing from the Schlossplatz into the streets beyond. Imposing stone buildings surrounded them, and the evening began to set in. Street lights flicked on, some broken, some working.
So, what's your plan from here?
We want you to sit tight for 2 weeks, and then make your way to Freiburg.
And then you will take my wife and me to America so that I can continue my work.
What age is your wife, Dr. Hahn?
53.
Bringing another person along, particularly a woman in her 50s, is going to make getting across the border to Switzerland all the more difficult. I'm sure a brilliant man like you can appreciate that.
That's the only way I'll go.
Franco tried to imagine what John might say. Perhaps John might get them across one by one, taking the wife first and coming back for Hahn. It was remote, but it might be possible.
Have you any way of bringing the work with you?
I've made microfilm of blueprints and plans. Bringing it along shouldn't be a problem.
And where is this microfilm?
Stashed, safely.
She was just about to ask him to elaborate when the shrill sound of the air raid sirens pierced the air. Franca could see the fear in his eyes.
An air raid, he said. We've got to get to a shelter.
How long do we have before the bombs begin?
It's hard to say with the valley we're built into, and the foggy conditions. The planes could be right on top of us. Are you coming with me?
I've nowhere else to go.
People began running, and mothers dragged children along by the arm.
There's a shelter a few minutes' walk away,
Hahn said. A shrill whistle cut him off, and a loud explosion rocked the street behind them. A storefront several hundred yards away exploded, showering the street with rubble and debris. A burglar alarm sounded. The sirens still howled. People scattered. Franco looked back and saw bodies on the asphalt. Hahn grabbed at her wrist as the whistle of bombs came again. 100 people or more were running down the street now. It was impossible to know how far away the bomb shelter was. She couldn't see it, could only see the scattered figures of people running. Hahn was slow. She was almost dragging him as another bomb struck, landing 100 feet behind them. A man was flung into the side of a building, as if swatted to the side by some giant hand, his corpse falling in an untidy heap. Another bomb, and then another, collided with the houses on either side of the street. Glass and debris sprayed out. Franca turned around and saw a man running behind her, his entire body consumed in yellow flames. He fell. People sprinted past, the sound of screaming left in their wake. Blind panic. Another bomb fell, and the building just in front of them exploded into the street, showering their path ahead with dust and rubble. There were dead all over the road in front and behind, and still the whistling of bombs filled her ears. Han slowed.
How far are we from the shelter?
She screamed.
Half a mile, perhaps. Usually there is more warning. The clouds!
Another explosion rocked the air around them, and Franco could see that the street they'd just run down was now a trail of fire. Several bodies lay burning like torches in the dimming light. The sky above was blackening. The planes were invisible. She saw a bomb, caught sight of the flare of black before it hit the ground, obliterating a grocer's shop, scattering glass and wooden boxes of vegetables like confetti. Another bomb fell, and the mutilated body of an old woman skidded to the asphalt a few feet in front of them. Her clothes were burned away, her skin charred black underneath, her jaw sheared off. Franco ran around her as another bomb exploded behind them. She lost Han for a few seconds in the haze of smoke, and then picked him out about 50 feet to her left. She made for him, just as another bomb hit, scattering debris. Dozens of people were lying broken all around her, screaming. Dozens more ran on. Franco stopped, rubbing at her eyes. She lost Han again, scanned the ground for him. Another explosion almost blew out her eardrum, knocking her off her feet. The buildings all around her were a sea of flames, sending black smoke billowing into the air. She wiped grit out of her eyes, tried to focus despite the ringing in her ears. She checked her body. No blood. She could move. Only a little pain. She rose to her feet, falling behind most of the crowd now. Another bomb exploded, but several hundred yards away this time. The thought emerged from the swamp of her mind that she was alone and still had to get to a bomb shelter. The crowd in front of her was still running toward the air raid shelter, which she could now see was a few blocks away. Where was Han? She felt a warmth flowing down the side of her face, and her hand came back stained with her own blood. The cacophony of the sirens was changed now, mixed with the agonized moans of the wounded. She stumbled across rubble and broken glass, searching for Han. She counted 7 dead within 50 feet of where she was standing, some missing arms and legs, others crushed under bricks and mortar. The whistling of the bombs came again, farther away now. The bombers had passed over, but that didn't mean they wouldn't come again. She still needed to get to a shelter. Staying out in the open meant death. Franca screamed as she saw him. Han was on the other side of the street, lying on his side in a pool of thick crimson. She stumbled to him and passed the outstretched hands of several, wounded and begging for help. It was against every instinct in her to ignore them, but she did. A faint voice inside her head reminded her to focus on the mission.
Han,
she said. Her voice seemed to echo within her, as if inside a deep black cavern. More explosions rocked the earth as she bent down to him. People were still running past. A young man shouted at her to come, tried to grab at her, but she shrugged him off. Han opened his eyes and lifted his head. Blood oozed out the sides of his mouth. He coughed, brought his eyes to hers. His clothes were wet with blood, the pool in front of him thickening by the second. His eyes implored her to help, though she knew there was nothing to be done. A loose piece of masonry lay on his legs, pinning him to the ground. She thought to drop him, to keep running toward the shelter. She remembered John, waiting for her in the cabin.
Where is the microfilm, Han?
His eyes flickered, and he managed nothing more than a grunt.
Don't let your research die on this street. You said that the Nazis didn't value your work. Let the Americans finish what you started.
He opened his eyes and was looking at her as she spoke now.
Where is the microfilm? Let me safeguard the work you've dedicated your life to.
Han tried to turn over, tried to move the concrete block off his legs. Franco reached under the block and strained as she attempted to lift it. It didn't budge, and Han, resigned to his fate, fell back to his original position. His breathing was getting shallower, the color running from his face. Franco knew he had only seconds now.
Dr. Han, don't let your work fall into Nazi hands. Let the Americans do something good with it.
Han caught his lips back in a bloody, macabre smile.
Like they've done here today. Do you even realize what I'm working on?
Nuclear fission? I don't know what that is. I knew it could change the tide of the...
It's a bomb. It's the most powerful bomb in history. A bomb that could level an entire city.
One bomb that could destroy a city?
That could incinerate thousands in seconds.
Don't let it fall into the Nazis' hands. Think of what they did to your Jewish friends and colleagues. Think of what they could do with that power.
Han closed his eyes for a second, and then opened them again for what Franca knew could be the last time.
It's in my apartment. 433 Kronenstrasse. It's close.
He coughed again.
Make sure they complete it. It's all there. Go now, while the raid is on, and the police are in the bomb shelter.
Where is it hidden?
More bombs went off, only a few hundred yards away. Franca knew she had to move. The bombers would come again.
The picture of my mother,
he said, his voice weakening.
Look into it.
His head fell back, his mustache coated in blood, his eyes open, staring into nothing. People flashed past. Franca was the only person not running who was able. Han's apartment was being watched. Why else would he have told her to go there now while the Allied bombers rained death on the city below? This could be Franca's only chance to resurrect the mission, to do her part to defeat the evil that had killed Hans and Freddy and her father. It took a few grisly seconds to rifle through his pockets for the keys. No one was watching. She left him lying there and ran with the others, the safety of the reinforced concrete air raid shelter coming into view at the end of the street. A haze of smoke and dust hovered in the air. The sirens were still blaring, and several of the buildings around her were ablaze. Dead bodies littered the way. She saw the name come into view. Kronenstrasse. The street was empty. No police, no soldiers, no Gestapo. And surely no Frau Hahn waiting for her ex-husband to come home. She'd never get another opportunity like this. She stopped for a second, her breath thundering in and out of her lungs, her hair wet with blood. The safety of the air raid shelter was 200 yards away. It could wait. She ran down Kronenstrasse, glancing up at the numbers of the buildings as she went. The bombs came again, and several explosions rocked the ground behind her. Smoking hulks, which had been buildings just moments before, lurched over her, ready to collapse into the street. The mission. The mission. She followed the numbers. 411. 413. A bomb fell to her right, hurling glass and concrete onto the road in front of her. She cowered down for a few seconds until she was sure there wasn't another one coming. She saw the apartment block and ran to the glass door, which was still untouched, and fumbled for the keys. She tried one, the wrong key, and then another, and the key turned. The door opened to a marble staircase. The elevator was a few feet away, but would be far too dangerous to use. The postbox on her right told her that Han lived, or had lived, in apartment 2B. She made for the deserted staircase as the entire building shook with a concussion from a nearby bomb. Survival would be pure chance. She crouched on the stairs, waiting for the sound to pass, and then continued up. Red-faced and panting, she made it to apartment 2B. The key slid into the lock and she pushed the door open. The thought arose that his wife may have still been there, but there was no time for hesitation. She ran into the living room, repeating the words he'd said over and over.
A picture of his mother,
she said, scanning the room. Old black-and-white photos filled frames on every table, and several hung on the wall. Who was his mother? And where would he hide the microfilm on a tiny frame like these? A closed door beckoned, and she ran to it. She pushed into the bedroom and saw above the bed the framed portrait of a traditionally dressed, stern-faced woman. Franca pulled it off the wall and placed it face down on a mattress. More explosions tore through the air, and now she could hear the sound of flak biting back at the airplanes above. The back of the picture was covered in brown paper, level with the sides, raised an inch off the picture itself. Franca dug her hand into the brown paper and tore it away. A small black object was taped to the inside of the frame in the bottom left corner. It couldn't have been anything else but the microfilm. Franca ripped it off and rammed it into her pocket. The bombs came again as she made for the stairs, and she waited until the noise stopped before continuing down. She burst out the door of the apartment block onto the ruined street. A man who'd been calling out for her help minutes before was now dead. It was hard not to look at him as she ran past. She kept her hand in her pocket as she went, her fingers coiled around the microfilm. The front door of the air raid shelter was shut, and she hammered on it with a closed fist and shouted to let her in. The door opened, and, panting, covered in dust and blood, she fell inside. Hundreds of people turned to stare at her, her hands stuck in her pocket, as if cast in iron. Hours passed. The bombing finally ended. The bandage the medic had placed on her head was itchy. He'd assured her that the gash was superficial, and that head wounds almost always looked worse than they were. She played dumb, nodding and smiling as he finished. The man beside her offered her his coat. She refused, and asked directions to the hotel she'd booked into, hoping it was still intact. She thought of the Allied airmen dropping the bombs, wondered if they knew what they were doing, who their bombs were killing. Were they war criminals, as most of the people in the air raid shelter would testify, or were things like accountability for war crimes decided by the victors? She doubted that most of the criminals of this war would ever see justice. Those on the side that emerged victorious would likely be lauded as heroes, their crimes remembered as exemplary actions. Streets and railway stations all over the world were named after people who some would hold up as war criminals. It was night when the crowd emerged from the shelter. Franca shuffled into an altered cityscape, the flames from the bombing still licking at the night. People said that it was the heaviest raid on Stuttgart so far. It would be days before the dead were all gathered and counted. Franca would be long gone by then. The citizens of Stuttgart walked like ghosts through the darkened streets, meandering around rubble and the bodies of those less fortunate than they. The howling of the sirens had ended for now, replaced by the wailing of tears and the silent guilt of those who had survived. Chapter 12. John sat at the window for much of the time she was gone. He was thinking about Penelope. She pined for someone else now. Another man awaited her letters. He imagined the airman holding the envelopes up to his nose, smelling the sweetness of her perfume, just as he once did. He hadn't thought about her much since she'd written that last letter to him, which certainly had not been sprayed with perfume. He thought back on how they'd laughed together, on how proud of her he'd been, and on how they'd made love. The bitterness within him had faded away. He wished he could see her, tell her that he was sorry, that she was doing the right thing. Her happiness had been the most important thing in the world to him once, and he hoped she'd rediscovered it with her new husband. It was impossible to be angry with her. Everything was his fault. He'd never cheated or even wanted anyone else, but he hadn't been there for her. He knew there would be no perfect goodbye. They would see each other again, perhaps at some black tie function, where they'd glance across a crowded room at one another. Perhaps they could talk and wish each other well. It was something to hope for. Thoughts of Franca seemed to intrude on everything else that crossed his mind. His attempts to wipe her from his consciousness were futile. She always came back. Her face seemed tattooed inside him. He fought the worry he felt for her. It was more convenient to treat her like any other asset. She would have her uses. But when he awoke that morning, he felt the lack of her in the coldness of that cabin. It felt empty. He made his way out of bed, shunting himself out of the bedroom and into the kitchen. The coffee was on the stove where he'd left it. Everything was untouched, except by his own hand. It felt unnatural. The feelings inside him were ridiculous. Surely a direct result of being cooped up here for so long. It was true that he hadn't seen a woman like Franca in a long time. It was natural he'd feel some affinity toward her. She'd saved his life. She was brave and honest and beautiful. He couldn't blame himself for inconvenient thoughts he couldn't master. He couldn't help that he'd memorized every curve of her face. There were some things beyond his control. He finished his breakfast of dried fruit, stale bread, and jam, and made his way out to the living room. His book was lying on the table by the firewood he'd need to light. He estimated that the logs would get them through another 3 days before Franca would need to go out for more. It didn't feel right sending her out into the snow, yet she never complained. She never complained about anything. It took him a few minutes to get the fire going to the stage where he was able to sit back and relax. He wished he could do more around the cabin, but he was hobbled. He was more hindrance than help. He wasn't using her. She volunteered. She was grateful for the chance to affect the outcome of the war against the regime that had destroyed her family and the country she loved. What were these feelings of guilt within him, then? Why did he feel like he'd sent her alone into the lion's den? He had told her how difficult Han was known to be. John was sure she could work it out for herself. She only needed to make contact, after all. Lunchtime came, and John was still by the fire, his book untouched on the table beside him. The sun was shining outside, and he could hear the dripping of the snow as the long melt began. He shifted the blanket he'd spread over his chest, reached for the radio, and flicked it on. The royal-tinted accent of the BBC newsreader fluttered over the airwaves. John had met many Englishmen. Few of them sounded like that. The newsreader read through a list of bombing raids from the night before. John's blood froze when he mentioned the raid on Stuttgart.
RAF Bomber Command conducted a stunning raid on the industrial stronghold of Stuttgart yesterday. Sources claim it's the biggest on that city of the war so far.
The raid had been small in comparison with the massive sorties that destroyed much of Hamburg and Cologne, but had been hailed as a major success. How many had died? He had sent her into the jaws of the Allied beast. Grisly thoughts consumed him. The newsreader moved on, giving little importance to the words that still echoed through John's mind. "There's a war on, goddammit," he said to no one. She knew the risks. He trained his eyes on the cuckoo clock in the hallway. It struck one. The minutes drew out like months until it was almost 5. Darkness was descending when the door finally opened. John couldn't see her as she dropped her skis in the hallway. He didn't call out. Franca appeared at the end of the hallway. A large white bandage adorned her forehead. She dropped her bag and shuffled inside. John stifled the instinct to express his relief upon seeing her. "Did you see him?" he asked.
"I saw him,"
she said. She made her way into the kitchen, emerging seconds later with a cup of water.
"The bombers came when I was with him. The entire city seemed to erupt into flames."
"Are you hurt?" She reached up and touched the bandage on her head.
"It's just a scratch. I was one of the lucky ones. Hundreds were killed. Thousands, maybe. Han died on the street."
"What? Are you sure?"
"I saw him. He died in front of me."
Barely able to hold her head up, she flopped down in a chair opposite him. John tried to pull his thoughts together. Han was dead. That meant his work for the Nazis was too. But what if somehow the Nazi path toward nuclear fission continued unabated? Without Han's knowledge, the scientists in America might not catch up until it was too late. John's superiors would never be satisfied without Han's knowledge at their disposal. It took him a few seconds to regain enough composure to speak again. "You aren't hurt." She shook her head. "What happened? How long did you see him for?"
"Just a few minutes. It turns out he was more of a mercenary than a dissident. He seemed more eager to get the work finished than to use it against the Nazis. He didn't appear to care so much who finished it. He was convinced that the Americans would give him the funding and facilities he needed."
"And so he would have," John said. "I heard about the attack. I'm relieved you're alive. What happened?" Franco went through everything from when she'd met Han to the moment he died. "What happened to the microfilm?" John said.
"Give me just a minute,"
Franco said. She went into the bathroom and returned seconds later with the plastic container. Her face was stern, rigid. He tried to get up, fumbling for his crutches. She went to him, and he slid back into his seat. "You got it."
"I went to his apartment after he died."
He reached for the tiny container in her hand. She curled her fingers around it.
"He told me what his project was about,"
she said. John sat back in the chair. The flickering light of the fire danced across the gentle lines in her face. "I told you everything I know. It's not my job to ask questions."
"He was developing a bomb that could level an entire city. Han was developing the most deadly weapon in the history of the world."
Her fist closed around the microfilm. "I didn't know it was a bomb. I just knew it was a technology that could change the war. It's up to us now to get this film back to the Allies before the Nazis realize what they have on their hands. If they develop that bomb before we do, can you imagine what they would do with it? They wouldn't hesitate to use it. Millions of innocent people would die."
"Millions of innocents are dying. I saw it with my own eyes. I witnessed what the Allied bombing raids are doing to the German people."
"This war is the Nazis' doing." He saw her move toward the fire. "Don't do it, Franca."
"You sound like a child arguing over who started it. This isn't some schoolyard brawl. Thousands of people are being slaughtered every day."
"What you have in your hand could go a long way toward ending that slaughter. The technology will be developed. Hundreds of the best minds in America are working on it every day. What you have in your hand could help them develop that bomb faster. It could end this senseless war."
"Or it could murder millions more."
"That's not for us to decide."
"Yet we are the ones who have that decision to make. I have it in my hand, so I am the one."
"Think before you do anything rash. Destroying that microfilm won't stop the research. Nothing will."
"At least I won't be contributing to the possible deaths of millions of innocent people."
"This is a race between the Allies and the Nazis. What if the Nazis develop that bomb first? Do you think they'd hesitate to use it? On London, or Moscow, or Paris?"
"Who's to say the Allies won't use it? I've seen the destruction they've brought to Germany."
"We don't have a choice about whether the bomb is made. Just who we help win the race to make it. Who do you want to win that race, the Allies or the Nazis?" She uncoiled her fingers from around the microfilm and handed it to John. "I know what you must be feeling."
"How? How exactly are you able to reach inside me?"
"I know this isn't straightforward, but it's not our place to make these decisions. We have to trust in our allegiances. You're doing the right thing."
"By helping with the creation of the most destructive bomb in human history? You'll excuse me if I don't see the sense in that."
"It is ironic, I'll certainly say that. But having a threat like this could force the Nazis to see that the war is unwinnable."
"You think that the threat of killing German civilians is going to bring the Nazis to heel? The Nazis care as much for the citizenry of this country as you might for something you dug out of your ear. They've used the people of this country for their own means since their inception. No threat against the people is going to end this. Only the destruction of the Nazis themselves."
John placed the case of microfilm on the table beside him. He picked up his coffee, long since cold, and took a swig anyway. "Thank you for what you did," he finally said. Not just for the war effort, but for me too.
What are you going to do?
I'll need to get this film across.